What advice do you have for the next person in your position? It's May 8th, 2018, and this is 508, a show about Worcester. Our panel today is Worcester legend Chris Humphrey, Brandon Mellican, who's not here yet, and me, Michael Benedetti. Today we're talking about leaving Worcester, knives, and the minimum wage. Brent crude oil is $76 a barrel, down 3% on the week. Bitcoin is $9,200, up 1% on the week. I'll do the rest of the station identification here in a second. Chris Humphrey, how you doing?
Doing great.
Cool. Let me. Right now we're in. We're streaming on Facebook in sepia, and I'm going to turn our color to a more regular color. How do I do that? Normal mode. All right. Is there a light that's not on? Chris, this is the kind of professionalism that you're getting by being here in 508. There we go. Now all of our lights are on. Mm-hmm. Chris Humphrey, we talked a couple times on this show about how the most Worcester tradition is leaving Worcester.
Of course.
There's no shame in leaving Worcester. Mm-hmm. People try to shame each other for leaving Worcester. You're fixing to leave Worcester. So we want to do an exit interview with you. Mm-hmm. Are you ready for this?
Yeah, do you have some questions for
me? I do. First, I want to ask about how did you come to work for the company or come to live in Worcester?
Well, you know.
You should get close. I think you should get closer to the mic. I don't know.
Oh, there's Brendan.
Yeah.
I was born into this world.
Uh-huh.
At UMass Memorial.
Well, you were born into a world you never made.
A world I never made. Like many, I was born at UMass Memorial.
Uh-huh.
Many a Worcesterite. I came out of the baby factory, and here I am today in Worcester. I've been here ever since.
So I think, because I sort of feel like, I mean, I don't know if you are the soul of Worcester, but I feel like people like you are the soul of Worcester. This is one reason why I really wanted to talk to you about this stuff. Why are you leaving? By the way, I'm not supposed to get into personal issues. I'm supposed to keep the conversation professional and work-related.
Okay. I mean, there is that spirit of tradition, and I do care a great deal about tradition. And so I do feel it is my time to leave. There is some love involved with it, too.
Uh-huh.
We don't have to go into that, obviously.
Okay.
I don't want to go against what you
said. I mean, you and I broke up, and we just decided we can't live in the same city anymore.
Well,
so one of us is moving.
We shouldn't get too into that. Okay. Yeah.
All right. What is the company doing right, moderately right, poorly, and very poorly?
Good questions. I think that Worcester is changing very quickly. It's unclear for the better or not yet.
Okay.
It's definitely changing. So this seems like a good time to get out.
Uh-huh.
Maybe I'll come back and see how it has changed. But I do think the city is on the move in some way, which I haven't seen in all of my years of living here.
And so, on balance, at least changing is potentially
change.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
What is the city doing poorly or very poorly?
I think, in general, like, these schemes of development have panned out in different ways, and I think that it's unclear where this one will pan out. It might be a crazy scheme, it might not, but I think over the years, the ways in which we've, like, tried to develop the city have oftentimes failed us,
mm-hmm.
Which is a very Worcester thing, too.
Okay.
Is these, like...
failed development.
These plans. Failed developments, because how many times was Worcester burnt down when it was first colonized? Like, 5 times?
Yeah, well, a couple of times.
And
I mean, let's not exaggerate. It was definitely more than one. But
more importantly, we're not out of matches yet. More importantly, we're not out of matches. I think that's the thing that we all got to keep in mind, right?
So maybe that's what we're doing well, is burning down.
All
but
right,
we rebuilt.
Right.
We rebuilt.
Okay. How could conditions be improved at the company?
I mean... more pay. Let's potentially lift the minimum wage. That's on the agenda today, right?
It is on the agenda. We're definitely going to talk about that.
I would like the city to raise my wage.
Okay.
The company, you know, more vacation time is always good.
Are you paid minimum wage?
By the city?
By the people that you work for? I feel like I know people that you work
for. I am paid more than minimum wage for the people I work for.
They're I was going to say.
The actual company I work for is great.
Okay. What would you do to improve the situation that's causing you to leave? I mean, we already talked about that. It would be you and me getting back together. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, it's going to take some time and space, and time heals all things. And
what I feel like all of these questions, I mean, like, please describe your general feelings about working here.
They've been great. I've had some ups and downs. I've seen some things. We've all seen some things.
We have seen some things. Are there, what would you change about our new employee orientation program? In other words, what are some things, what are things that you wish you had known before or during the beginning part of your employment with the company?
I wish I knew more about my fellow juggalos.
You wish you knew more about the juggalos? Okay.
I wish I knew more about my fellow juggalos in the city and ways in which I could relate with them more.
It sounds like cross-pollination between departments is something we need to work on.
Yeah, I think there needs to be some intermingling, some...
It is. It remains this thing about Worcester that it's like, it's just these concentric circles that don't meet and that are very hard to, like, discover each other.
And through years of being around juggalos, I've learned that there's a lot we have in common, and I think it's a very Worcester thing.
Okay. Who are three people who have made the most positive impact on you and your career here at the company?
Mike Benedetti, of course.
I mean,
Graduate, wonderful show.
You can think about that for a second if you want to. I could ask you the next question, which is, what advice do you have for the next person in your position?
Anyone who is coming into the company from outside, know that there is plenty of opportunities. Worcester is very porous. There's a lot of stuff happening that you can link into. Don't get disheartened. Find your community. Meet a juggalo. Talk to them.
You know, I was just watching an old episode of House this morning, and they had some advice written up on the chalkboard. And one piece of advice was something about how if you drink 2 cups of coffee a day, your chance of liver cancer goes way down. And another thing was, if you meet anybody who's especially strange or unnerving, befriend them.
I think that's great advice for anyone coming to Worcester, for sure.
At least give it a shot.
At least give it a shot.
It will definitely backfire, but if you don't do it, your time in Worcester is going to be... It's why are you even here?
Buy that strange person a cup of coffee. Kill 2 birds with 1 stone.
Yeah.
Oh, you're a genius, Brendan Milliken.
That's why I showed up.
Well, thanks, Chris. Did you think any more about the three people besides sucking up to me who've been most good in Worcester?
I think there's so many great institutions in Worcester. I think spaces like Stone Soup are great spaces. I think there's so many wonderful organizers in the city doing awesome things. I could list off a million organizations, but I do really think that there's so many important community organizations that are doing the work who have kind of influenced me in a lot of ways in my time here.
I'm really curious to hear your opinion, your thoughts around Worcester, whenever you've, like, lived away for, like, a year.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I've lived in Worcester my whole life. I've spent brief amounts of time outside of Worcester from doing, like, farming over the summer and things like that. Whenever I've come back, there's always this feeling that whenever there's incremental change, it's never been major, but there's still, like, this general spirit of Worcesterness that remains in the people who are there, and I can feel like I can jump back into that home, and so maybe this experiment of moving will bring me back here. But you can never escape Worcester.
I guess one last question, and then we can move on to another topic. What kind of a person, if somebody's wondering, should I move to Worcester? Like, what kind of a person would you say, oh yeah, you should definitely move to Worcester? What kind of a person would get something out of moving to Worcester?
Yeah, I think Worcester is a place where there's a lot of room to kind of grow in weird ways. I think that there's a lot of folks who are doing a lot of really cool different projects, whether it's art or activism. And I think that in larger cities, it can sometimes be more stifling as those communities are larger and resources are kind of leveled out in different ways. But I think Worcester is this place where you can come and really grow in the ways you want to, and there's a community that will support you.
We could say Worcester's a place that you could move if you want, thinking about making a lateral change in your life.
And you want to get weird.
Or you just want to experiment. that if you already have like a hard-driving career,
yeah, exactly.
Moving to Worcester is probably almost certainly a mistake if you think it's going to improve your career. But if you are looking to switch careers, if you're not sure what career
change
you want.
Change it up. Move to Worcester.
Change it up. Move to Worcester.
Not Boston. Or Providence. Philadelphia. Who knows?
Philadelphia could be great. Yeah, I hope you have a good time in Philly. So we could talk about the city council agenda, we could talk about the minimum wage, we could talk about knives, we could talk about housing.
How much time do we have before break? Because I would love to jump into the unprepared.
We have about two minutes. 6 minutes or 2 minutes, depending on whether you talk to me or the person who actually
knows. I would love to just throw this out to the two of you, then maybe when we get back into the next, after the break, go into minimum wage.
Yeah.
I had my first, so I don't ever do fast food, it's really rare, right? And then, so last week, first time this year, stopped into the McDonald's over at Hattie Square because it was jammed up for time and food, whatever. I saw my first self-serve kiosk. They have them, two of them, in the McDonald's. And it was this crazy experience on so many levels. As somebody who is totally, even as a small business owner, totally supportive of the Fight for 15 movement, that experience, which I used because I hadn't seen them and I wanted to, it really like forced a lot of questions that we've talked about on the show, I think for a couple of years now, since you first mentioned Flippy.
Yes.
That there are side factors that might actually have implications for that Fight for 15 movement in particular, that are seems so out there, but actually turned out they're just down the street. And when we can actually have some time to flesh that one out, I would love to layer that on whatever you guys had in mind about minimum wage talks.
This is 508, Worcester's week-by-week good faith survey of evidence. We'll be back in a moment with more. All right.
I started listening to that on the way down here, and that was the most fantastic setup. I feel like we need to figure out a way. We need to hire somebody for the city to do exit interviews for every person that's leaving. I mean, I know lighthearted and whatnot, but that was, in all seriousness, one of the most meaningful conversations I think I've heard about leaving the city of Worcester.
They are tough questions. The thing I also realized is that the blog post that I downloaded to read these from,
yeah.
A lot of these questions are very repetitive. They're not very helpful.
Well, it's like when you're doing a survey from Google, right? Like, it's part of it, it's a trick, right? Like, they're also trying to figure out whether or not you're making up answers as you go along, so you have, like, the layered sort of questions to see if you change up your answer.
Well, this is like one of those, this is one of those tests to see if you're a psychopath, where it's like, would you kill a bug? And then later on, it's like, would you kill a dog? And if you're like, if you're like, no, I would never kill a bug, but I would kill a dog, they're like, we got you.
Is the bug on the dog, and can I use a gun? That's, yeah. But that, seriously, that was really well done.
Well, great. Hey, everybody at home. I hope you enjoyed as much as Brendan did. I don't even know where we are on time. I feel like I'm confused.
Well, in the beginning, it was 22 after. Okay. Then in the morning shows, people felt that was a little bit too long because they were just doing those setups. So it went to like anywhere between 15 and 18 minutes after.
Okay.
So that's what I was thinking. But.
Okay. I'm just going on based on the old time.
Yeah. So it was, but that's fine.
Okay. Are we ready to go back in?
We have 30 seconds.
All right.
Yeah, and that concentric rings thing, too. Man, I've had so many just recently experiences with people, most recently at the bank. A young woman banker, a new teller, walked in wearing this hat, and she, like, completely lost her mind. She's like, Pablo's the greatest thing in the city. Like, how do I find out what's happening to her? And I was flummoxed because even though I'm on the committee, like, I didn't know how to answer such a simple question from somebody who, like, on the committee side. We're always, like, I think
you're always like, oh, yeah, we're inviting.
You just work with the mindset that everyone knows what's up.
Museum of Oddities. And on the inside, you're going to see nature's greatest mistakes. Grace McDaniel, look through the doorway. You're looking at Grace McDaniel, the mule-faced girl. You're going to look down into the beady eyes of a 23-foot python. You're going to see the giant spider, the octopus, eight-legged monster that can grow more than 30 feet in length. You're going to see the jaws of a live man-eating shark. Rolls and rolls of vicious teeth, the barracuda ape, the devilfish from Atlantis. You're going to see two Burmese pythons alive, over 50 different attractions on the inside, and you're just in time. Stop. Look through the doorway. Look through the doorway. Look through the doorway. They're in there right now. A two-headed calf, a two-faced calf, a raccoon with two heads. That's right, two heads on one body, a live tarantula spider, and Brendan Mulligan. And Chris Humphrey and myself, Michael Benedetti, on 508, your voice of the sideshow. Hi, guys.
What's happening?
We're going to talk about the minimum wage. So we have a thing coming up in the fall. There's going to be a ballot measure to increase the minimum wage in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Is that the idea? And this is for 15, the fight for 15. Yeah. All right. So the thing, I mean, like, the news hook that I have this week is this. Did you see this? States bishops urge support for increasing minimum wage?
I did.
I'm just gonna read a little bit of this. There's four Roman Catholic bishops in Massachusetts, and they have a group called Massachusetts Catholic Conference, and they released a statement in support of raising the minimum wage. In a civilized society, every hardworking individual deserves to be compensated at a rate that's fair, just, and in line with the inherent dignity that we're all God's children, regardless of economic status. A fair and just wage directly supports the individual, the family, and ultimately promotes a healthy society. The Catholic Church teaches, and here they quote from the Catechism about why just wage is good. A just wage is the legitimate fruit of work. To refuse or withhold it can be a grave injustice. In determining fair pay, both the needs and contributions of each person must be taken into account. Remuneration for work should guarantee man the opportunity to provide a dignified livelihood for himself and his family on the material, social, cultural, and spiritual level, taking into account the role and productivity of each, the state of business, and the common good. Agreement between the parties is not sufficient to justify morally the amount to be received in wages. As detailed in our statement titled The Value of a Just Wage, and I think that this is a statement they did a few years ago, the Catholic Church continues to be among the state's largest social service providers. Basic daily necessities of life are provided to those who cannot provide for themselves or their families. All families and individuals should be given the opportunity to break the cycle of reliance on others by providing wages that are just and fair to both employers and employees. That opportunity will become a reality to hardworking individuals. It is the position of the Roman Catholic Bishops of Massachusetts that elected officials, or alternatively voters in the upcoming ballot question in November, should enact laws that put a structure in place to increase the hourly minimum wage over the next several years. While the specific wage amounts are best determined by economists or other experts, we stand united in advocating for the neediest in society. Brendan Mulligan with Counterpoint.
No, you know, I don't have a counterpoint. It's funny because this is one of those issues that I feel really very strongly that it just makes sense, right? Like, especially in a place like Worcester that I think has always been somewhat economically depressed from the outset. Ceiling is kind of low relative to other cities our size in New England as a whole, or at least if we're comparing ourselves to Boston and Providence. So yeah, living wage, I mean, it's a tough thing to argue with from a moral or economic perspective. When Seattle did this a couple years ago, the thing of note that I thought kind of got glossed over a lot was the very next earnings call that Wendy's had as a company. They pointed out that, hey, we've had the technology to start automating our front of house for quite some time. Seattle has now shown us the way, basically, because the argument internally was always the hardware, the technology is too expensive to roll out. But then there's this point where suddenly humans cost more than the technology. And they announced that they had a plan over the next 10 years that they were going to start automating most of their ordering front of house. Well, yeah, that stood out to me as like an important thing to keep an eye on because, again, when we're talking about raising the minimum wage, a lot of the impact is on frontline service employees, right? And a lot of those folks do fall into the fast food world in particular, which are giant corporations and have the ability to roll out, you know, waves of technology very quickly and, yes. And then cover their own costs over decades, if necessary. So, as I was saying before the break, that was one of those things, it's been in the back of my head. I mention it anytime I talk to politicians about this, folks who are, you know, advocating for or fighting against, that it's at least something we need to be keeping in mind. And then, like I said, you know, last week I finally saw one of these kiosks for the first time. Two of them, actually. I don't know how many of them exist in Worcester for...
These are at Wendy's?
It was at a McDonald's, okay. Actually. And for those of you who haven't seen them that are either watching or listening, if you've ever been in an Apple store and seen one of the full-size, like, life-size iPhone, like, demo things that you can actually go up and basically is a fully functional iPhone that's really just on a giant touchscreen
TV. I've been in an Apple store so many times. Why haven't I seen this?
They usually do have them out when they're doing a rollout a new iPhone sort of thing. It basically looks like that, and it's the easiest thing in the world. You just, like, you ham-fist some, you know, big icons of what you want to order.
You just, like, punch a hamburger, punch some fries.
That's totally it. But so the experience, though, and it wasn't just that the technology just made perfect sense and worked and you can pay right there. Mm-hmm. It was while I was doing this, and kind of like as a nerd, like, I had to do that. I just wanted to go through the motions, see how easy it was and whatnot. The entire time I was doing it, the young woman who was at the register with no customers kept yelling over my shoulder, "Oh, if you're having a hard time with that, I can take your order." And then it got to the point for payment. She's like, "You know, you can also pay over here if you want to." And I'm like, no, I'm cool. And I just kind of kept going through the process. And right as my, like, ticket receipt was coming out, you know, she just kind of went, like, very dejected looking, just kind of walked by me with a spray bottle and a rag in her hand to go clean tables. Mm-hmm. And it was this sort of, like, light bulb moment that, like, while her job might not go away, her job just changed drastically, right? Like, instead of being, like, a human-facing customer service person, now she's mopping floors or in the bathrooms cleaning those, like, doing a lot more menial tasks that then, I think, almost reforces the original question that you get from opponents from raising the minimum wage is, where is the line in which, you know, this level of work is worth X number of dollars? And I think that's a really dangerous, kind of ugly moral question to go down, but it's the obvious question that I think business owners and economists put out there, which oftentimes doesn't have an easy answer, because I don't think any of us could actually answer that. So yeah, that was just an interesting experience, or what I thought was an interesting experience I had just a week ago, where it hasn't changed my mind at all about, you know, this is the right thing to do, but I do fear and have felt for a couple of years.
It's going to be disruptive in ways that, I mean, it is definitely going to be disruptive in ways that we're not anticipating, or that are not a big part of the debate.
And I think we all, generationally, you know, whether we're our general age or we're in our 70s, you know, one of those things that we've all said for years, there's always been kind of that specter of automation is going to take away all of our jobs, right? And every generation has felt that way at some point in time and then realized, no, the jobs are just changing.
Since the Industrial Revolution.
Totally. But then there's this kind of weird thing that is happening where a lot of technology is actually starting to get better than humans, right? We're in a world where really smart people like Elon Musk are sitting around saying, hey, yeah, this AI stuff is getting kind of weird, guys, and you want to keep an eye on it. And it's
right.
Like there are things happening in the tech sector that were unimaginable, I think, outside of science fiction only a couple years ago, maybe a decade or two ago, that are starting to creep into reality. And now suddenly I think the labor market is one of those places. And the thing that, I mean, at what point in time do we need legislation to say that robots can't, or, you know, touchscreens can't take over our service industry jobs? Is there actually an easy fix? And how long does that go on? And I guess that kind of forces the next big question, which is, in a weird way, why are we even talking about this? Like, why are we not actually having bigger, headier conversations about things like universal basic income, like mm-hmm. things that, you know, at least one city in the United States, Sacramento, California, has a pilot program for UBI out there now. There's a couple provinces in Canada that have been playing with the idea. This isn't new for anybody in certain parts of Europe. I don't know. And I'm not even sure what we should be having for what the right conversation is anymore. I just... I'll stop filibustering. One last thought. I think we could have probably all agree that one of the problems we have with, like, legislating anything is wondering whether or not our lawmakers or even the general public know enough about any one subject mm-hmm. to be the folks who are putting policy out there and making those decisions. And I think this is one of those areas where the answer is almost always no. They don't know enough about what's in the pipeline already to be making those decisions.
Chris Humphrey, you disagree with all of that. Tell me your reasons.
I don't disagree with all of that. I do think it is interesting to think of.
You got to talk into that mic, man.
Sorry. I don't disagree with all of that, and I do think it's important to reframe a lot of the conversations maybe towards the UBI sort of stuff, because mm-hmm. I do think it's like, where do we see the value in, like, where does the human component fit in all of this? Mm-hmm. And I think there are so many unanswered questions, and I do think like these companies are going to find ways to adjust these things and use technologies that will ultimately change the way we work our jobs and the way our economy is completely structured and function.
Don't tap the table.
I'm not going to tap the table anymore.
Okay. No. I have a lot of concerns with UBI or sovereign wealth funds or however somebody wants to do that, but I do see like one huge positive to UBI is that then you're not micromanaging what you can use a robot for, and you're just telling companies like, hey, you're just saying like, hey, Elon Musk, get as rich as you want, do as much badass stuff as you want. It's like, that's great, and we'll just like tax you enough so that like, I don't know, like people who like have skills that are not automated can like get jobs and like have a good life that way. And people who are like, you know, actually like, I'm not smarter than an AI. I'm not stronger than a robot. Like, you know, I'm not more creative than an AI. Like, okay. But like that person is not therefore like starving in Blade Runner.
You know, now I'll be the first to concede that it might even be unfair to layer those two concepts, right? Because when we're talking about minimum wage, we're talking, that's a right now sort of concept, right?
Like
we're dealing with people who there's no other way to put it, are not getting paid enough money to actually survive, and that's a right now problem. UBI, I think, is something that is a little bit headier and philosophical in the sense that we still have a problem. I think that it's a Western problem. It might even be, at this point, a uniquely American problem. I view it as a problem, where we still have this puritanical idea that value is always inextricably linked to work and output. And as someone who kind of likes to think of themselves as at least moderately or in another parallel universe creative person, I just wholly reject that idea that the only value you can provide humanity is the amount of labor that you're putting out. And obviously that's changed over the last century drastically, as we've created a middle class through some weird financial games.
But it's going to change back.
And it's going to change again, and it's changing right in front of us.
We're going to have such hardcore feudalism.
But we don't have to, though, because I mean the reality is the one thing that I think we dance around is that whatever we want to label as the generator of wealth and the marker of wealth in society, that doesn't actually go away, right? The only thing that seems to be starting to go away is the number of human hands that need to be involved with making any one thing or producing any one thing. The value still exists. So it's kind of like the Star Trek ideal, right? Like at some point in time, you just pull like the physical representation out of money, out of the equation, and reality doesn't actually have to change for anybody, right? It's just, it doesn't even have to go in a way that would upset a lot of Americans into a full boat socialism or communism sort of thing. It's just kind of logic, right? Like we use money as a representation of labor. If the labor market changes drastically, then you just remove that representation and nothing actually has to change. The production stays high and people have the things that they need. And it's just a system in the background that's making sure that people's needs, at least core needs, are being met on a regular basis and with consistency.
Thanks, Joel. How many minutes do we have left in this segment? We only have 1 minute left in this segment.
We can solve this problem.
Holy cow. Yeah. I'm not sure if we're Worcester's libertarian voice so much these days. The city council, this week's city council agenda is not that exciting to me. I didn't even write up an official email. I do have a couple of items we can talk about after the break. I think I just want to mention this real quick. Behind me is the Barracuda Ape. You know, today's sideshow thing mentions the Barracuda Ape. And I was like, what is a Barracuda Ape? And it's apparently this.
There it is.
Sorry, I'm leaning the wrong way. There it is. Also a tarantula. Mm-hmm. I like how it's like we have a two-headed raccoon and we have a tarantula.
What a time to be alive. Or I mean, how many friends did you grow up with that were, maybe they might have been a little bit on the odd side, but they had, you know, a Burmese python or two, and they'd invite you over when they were feeding at a rat or something?
I definitely used to find tarantulas around the neighborhood when I grew up in Oklahoma. I like the idea that I could have gone on the road with that tarantula.
You know what they didn't have and what we still don't have is a pet wallaby, Mike. And that's where there's room for improvement.
We talked about this before. Okay. This is 508, your transit advocacy voice. We'll be back in a second with more.
Did we talk about wallabies on the show?
We did, yeah.
Okay, I thought we did. Because it's like a mini pig.
Yeah. It's more of like a mini kangaroo.
No, teacup pigs.
Yeah, sort of.
Which
like,
are
yeah.
Mini
yeah.
pigs.
Yeah, so, I don't know.
Let's talk about knives.
Can we just acknowledge, before we talk about knives, that
yeah.
this is going to be a really tough one? We might as well be talking about, you know, the orangutan that's in the studio for the radio guests. I don't know how many there are, but we'll be talking about physical implementations, and they can't see them, so we're going to be really, really good in our description.
We'll make a zoom down to like an area out.
Oh no, they'll see it.
Let me put a zoom.
How did this morning go with Alan? Was it
good?
Good?
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
fantastic.
It's going to be a great project. I really am looking forward to seeing 13 months, he said.
Yeah.
That's when he anticipates being ready to open.
Yeah.
Did I give you one of these? Have you seen this issue?
No, it's just brand new.
It has, on the back, it has the essay about Worcester burning down.
Oh, great.
Which I did in literally wrote in tribute to you.
That's what I thought about all day today. It was on my mind presently.
Ladies and gentlemen, Chris usually does not kiss my ass to the extent that he's doing it today. I don't know what's going on.
I just think it's a good, it's a good lesson.
Yeah, I'm going to read about the knife ordinance.
And how
which has always been confusing.
How all three of us are violating that right now?
Oh, yeah.
A wild man, a crazy man, and he's in there now with those creepy crawly reptiles, and they're crawling all over that poor boy's body. He's not all there, but he is here. He is alive. Look at what they're looking at. See what they're seeing. Your friends and neighbors have seen him. Come in and see him now. Your mind will fail to believe what your eyes will see. Chris Humphrey, Brenda Milliken, and me, Mike Benedetti.
There you are.
Let's talk about knives, gentlemen.
All right.
Because this is Worcester's Libertarian Voice, so we got to talk about knives. We were just talking during the break about the knife ordinance. In 2009, Worcester adopted a new ordinance with a $300 fine for anyone arrested for disturbing the peace or on a warrant while carrying a knife longer than 2.5 inches, unless they had a good reason. The city manager originally asked the council to crack down on even peaceable possession of pocket knives larger than 1.5 inches, unless carried for a job or outdoor recreation. Back when the average person was more comfortable with using tools and with hacking in their environment, restrictions on pocket knives would have seemed as ludicrous as restrictions on pencils or watches. As Bruce Sterling wrote of multi-tools in general, a multi-tool changes your perceptions of the world. Since you lack your previous untooled, learned helplessness, you will slowly find yourself becoming more capable and more observant. If you have pocket scissors, you will notice loose threads. If you have a small knife, you will notice bad packaging. If you have a file, you will notice flashing metallic burrs and bad joinery. If you have tweezers, you can help injured children, while if you have a pen, you will take notes. Tools in your space, saving your time, a multi-tool is a design education. What do we got, Brendan? What do you got for a knife today?
I think I told you, so I just picked this up actually. I was, I've been looking for one of these for a while.
Let's put it on our cardboard thing.
So that's Benchmade. I'm a big fan of Benchmade knives, and you know, I've gotten to the point, I've been using Kershaw's for years, which are really, really nice knives, but they're kind of disposable, both from a price perspective, and then the steel isn't that great on them, and it's been so long since I've lost one, I've kind of convinced myself that I can be trusted with nicer knives. Benchmade makes some really good stuff, made here in the United States. So that's a model they released last summer called the Bug Out, which is, it's 1.8 ounces.
It's super, it's like bizarrely lightweight. Chris Humphrey, do you want to play with this knife? We're totally violating knife safety, by the way, on the show today, because we're...
So it's 1.8 ounces. Most of the hardware is titanium. It was made kind of for the backpacker, like the ultralight backpacker crowd. And it, I think it kind of fits like the sort of minimalist ideal, which I'm a big fan of.
It's called the Bug Out, right?
Bug Out, yeah. And so this version of it actually just came out last month, and I found a local retailer that happened to have it in stock, but also, I don't know if for those at home, it's actually first run in a numbered version of first run.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, kind of cool stuff, and hopefully I don't lose that one.
Yeah, this is a cool knife. So this has, yeah, so this is a cool knife. And this is probably, what, like a 3-inch blade or something?
A little bit over. I think maybe it's 3 1/4, just under 3 1/4.
So you could carry it in Worcester if you're being peaceable, but you couldn't carry it in Boston, I think.
If I'm being peaceable or doing a job, I can carry it. Boston, no, I get stopped at the line, apparently.
Chris Humphrey, what do you got?
So I brought two knives today, one of which is the CRKT Columbia Knife River Trading Co. Drifter, which I cut on to through spending way too much time on some everyday carry blogs. Mm. It's very slim. I think it does fit under the 2-inch law, or just about hits it. Super lightweight. I've had it for years. Has a nice clip. Says Drifter on it, because that's important.
It does say Drifter on it.
So that's kind of my everyday carry knife, and I use it for most things. But I also brought a Morica Niv, which is a very basic low-end work knife I've used for farming, which isn't a full tang knife, meaning like the steel doesn't go all the way through, but it's pretty sturdy, and you can get it in a variety of different types. You can get a version that's bushcraft. I think there's a Bear Grylls version with like a fire starter in it. That's like safety orange. But that version is, the version I brought today is a heavy, so it has more steel to it. It's a little heavier, but I've used it to chop some pieces of wood. I've used it for all of my like farm harvest.
Yeah, you do, because you do like farm kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And I get it. Yeah. Both knives are fairly cheap.
Did I try to sharpen this for you recently, or was
yes.
I trying to? Yes. You know, I'll tell you. I mean, this. I'm glad you brought this. Like the thing I found out about this is it has a recurve on it. Mm-hmm. That means it's like kind of bent back in here on the blade. Mm-hmm. Makes it so much harder to sharpen. So much harder to sharpen. It's, or at least for me, for somebody who like me who doesn't know what they're doing, so much harder to sharpen. Here's what I got. I got this. This is my number one knife to talk about today. This is the. Go ahead and look at it, Brendan. This is the Canary cardboard cutter. You know, whenever you read the knife blogs, people frequently talk about they're testing a knife on cutting boxes and opening packages because we all live the Amazon lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And I tell you, if you're doing farm work or you're stabbing grizzlies, you want something with a real blade on it. And if you're opening packages or cutting cardboard, this does a great job. Let me see if I can demonstrate this. I just feel like this does such a good job. Like, I'm just kind of like cut whatever. Like kind of a thing here.
You cut your finger right off?
No, it won't cut your finger, right? Like, you know, none of it is sharp. Like I would not let toddlers play with this, but I have accidentally let toddlers play with this and they didn't hurt themselves. It's good for opening letters. It has like a fluoride non-stick coating on the blade, kind of like EMT shears do, which is nice. At the Veg Fest was the last time I used my knife a bunch. Actually, last night I cooked dinner with another knife I'll show you. Veg Fest was the last time I used my knife a bunch, and I had my tiny little Swiss Army knife, and I kept opening all these boxes with it, and that cheap tape just gummed up the edge. Yeah. After about 6 boxes, I couldn't open anything more with this knife, and I was like, I'm not going to go take 5 minutes to find a paper towel. I'm just going to switch to a different knife. Mm-hmm. This thing doesn't have that problem. I mean, I've never cleaned this. I've been using this for like 4 months now. Maybe, I mean, you can't sharpen it, obviously. Maybe I'll have to sharpen it before the end of the year. I don't know. But
the amazing thing about just the visual of that is it kind of looks like just the blade. I know it's not exactly that, but it kind of looks like, Japan?
A tiny lightsaber.
Well, no, it kind of looks like a butter knife.
And it does look like a butter knife.
Like, I'm kind of looking at it wondering, are butter knives not something that are prevalent in Japan? And it, like, was this invented without folks realizing that?
Feel free to cut some cardboard with it. I don't think you can cut cardboard with a butter knife very well. This thing was just like...
That's actually...
It separates through cardboard. Yeah, I mean, again,
it's
like...
Ron Popeil over here.
I am, I'm just here to... And this is...
Do you have a tin can?
This is an $8 investment. You can buy this on Amazon. Okay. You can buy this on Amazon. I don't know how you get out of the box. Mm-hmm. You have to have another knife to get out of the box. But after that, you're all set. And it's a good letter opener. And it won't... I used to always use a straight razor that I have as my letter opener. And package opener, and then a couple of times I would damage the contents of something. Also, straight razor, a pain in the neck to keep sharp. This better. Okay, other thing I got here, though, is more knifey. And this is, I'll give this to you, Brendan. This is something, or I'll let you look at this. This is something which I got from MassDrop. MassDrop is this site that you turned me on to.
Is this Ferrum Forge?
It is Ferrum Forge. This is a knife which is designed by some dudes out of San Diego.
That's really nice.
It's made by a company called WE Knives out of China, who are a very high-end knife makers, I guess. And the whole thing package is put together and sold by the people at the MassDrop website. Mm-hmm. And it's just like a nice knife. So I used this to cook dinner last night, and it did an okay job. Like, I realized that, like, really, if you're, like, really, you know, like a chef's knife makes sense, or like a real paring knife makes sense, because you kind of want the blade to be like, if the blade is down here, it's like easy to cut things than if the blade is up here. But you can cook a big thing, a stew or whatever, with this.
So that's the one thing that I can't get used to with this Benchmade that I have, is that has a very similar flipper from the Kershaw's that I've been using. Kershaw calls them speed safe. I don't know what the Ferrum Forge folks call it, but it's kind of an interesting thing, because someone just mentioned a minute ago how confusing both Massachusetts knife laws and then local knife laws are, and there's no preemption on the state level, but... There's a weird gray area, or not. It shouldn't be, though, because it's not spelled out anywhere in the MGL. Like, Amazon won't sell you Kershaw's with the SpeedSafe flipper on it.
Does it have like a spring-loaded thing?
No spring. It's just like that. It's actually just using the whether it's a bearing or whatever it is that's holding the blade in place. That's the torsion that you put on that, or the force that you put on that, causes the knife to look like it's springing open, but you're really just pulling it open with your finger. Mm-hmm. So Amazon, in their reading of Mass state law, won't ship Kershaw's to Massachusetts anymore if they have that speed safe feature, but you can go to Walmart or Dick's or any other sporting goods store and pick them up. Mm-hmm. It's funny how when you see in the corporate channels, where I think most people would buy a pocket knife, even they can't make heads or tails of state law, to the point where they're just saying, fine, we're not going to bother anymore.
Because it talks about automatic knives, right, or something like that.
Which, you know, I won't mention the name of the business, but I mentioned to you the other day, I found a place locally that is selling automatic knives, because their understanding of the law is there's nothing, the way it's spelled out, you could easily, I think a lawyer would interpret it as, if you have a license to carry, that would not prohibit you from owning or what the state would consider a switchblade. Mm-hmm. There are still regulations about where you can carry it, because, like, again, technically owning a switchblade isn't illegal in Massachusetts. Carrying a switchblade or selling a switchblade is illegal in Massachusetts. Okay. None of it makes any sense at all. And it's one of those areas, too, that nationally there are some pretty big organizations that are involved with trying to re-legislate knife laws across the country to try and make them somewhat universal, because it doesn't make any sense from state to state.
The TSA came so close to redoing the TSA regulations around knife carrying a couple of years ago. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
And this son of a bitch representative named Ed Markey screwed the whole thing up in conjunction with these flight attendant unions. But it also came so close to happening.
Mm-hmm. It is a funny...
I will never vote for Markey because of that.
So I carry a knife. I've carried a pocket knife since I was probably 5 or 6 years old, which I think today would probably terrify a parent of a 5 or 6 year old. But my grandfather was a firefighter. And I remember when I was probably 5 years old, CVS used to sell on the counter these little chrome-plated, they were like round-tipped pocket knives that had a really dull blade on it. And it was really like a little keychain knife. And I remember my grandfather buying one for me when I was like five. And it was just, he was of the generation and the job of it, of his whole career, where you always just carried a knife. So the younger you learned how to hold one and handle one responsibly... Still have the scar on my index finger on my right hand, where I almost cut the tip of my finger off when I was probably 6 or 7 years old with that very knife. Mm-hmm. It's just such a normal thing. But when you look culturally, like, we're kind of at the point now in a lot of states, especially coastal states, where maybe Boston, I mean, anything that's larger than your pinky nail is pretty much no-go. The mayor of London just 2 weeks ago was suggesting...
Said there's no reason anyone should carry a knife.
Well, but it's also an interesting thing.
God bless America.
Culturally, but that stemmed from London.
We should have a revolution against those guys.
I know, what are we waiting for? London had more more murders by stabbing in the first couple months of this year than New York City had of all murders, right? So they're also in this really weird spot where, you know, everyone on that side of the pond making fun of us because we of our fascination with guns, but their murder rate is still actually going up. It's just the tools are changing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's some really interesting philosophical conversations to be had there.
I want to ask you, Brendan, yes. I only know this because I looked it up this morning. What do you think the average number of stabbings in Worcester is a year based on police reports?
I honestly couldn't even guess what the number is, but can I guess that it's gone? Has it gone down though?
So it peaked in... It went up for a couple of years, and then it peaked in 2009. Then it dropped real low. Then it peaked again in 2013, and since then it's dropped every year since 2013.
So, and I think that's the important story of, regardless of what we're talking about, is that in the United States, our violent crime rates have been plummeting for a significant amount of time, and we still allow ourselves, oftentimes in the media, to pretend as though, you know, the sky is falling. It's never been a more dangerous place. The two periods of time that you just mentioned also came along with some pretty significant socioeconomic baggage as well, too, with, like, you know, total market collapses and whatnot. You could probably figure out some causation between those peaks in the number of not just stabbings, but violent crime in general in relationship to unemployment, lost wages, and housing challenges and whatnot as well.
How many minutes do we have left in the segment, Hank Stoltz?
We're
0 minutes.
They actually cut us off 10 minutes ago.
This is 508, Worcester's Libertarian Voice. We'll be back with more knife and gun talk in just a moment.
I love these things. I've never seen one in person. It's always been on. There's one in my shopping cart on Amazon that's been there for like 3 years now.
They're so cheap, and I've used it for so much. I've used it to chop big chunks of wood, like batoned it.
The last time I was really close to buying one, I ended up buying a K-Bar, just because, like, I never owned one, and they're super, super cheap on Amazon now, but they also make them with synthetic handles, which are nice as well. The grips are not leather. You can still get the old-school leather ones and whatnot, but...
I'll tell you what I don't like about this knife is that I feel like the knife I always have is like my little Swiss Army knife, right? Yeah. And I'm like, oh, okay. Like, I feel like you can open this anywhere and nobody's going to react. This knife, I've only owned this knife for like a week now, and it's like so nice to open it.
People jump.
It feels like this is a real like...
I've only used my Kershaws really, I mean, I always have them with me backpacking or camping or whatnot, and they've served me well in that capacity, but it's primarily kind of just a box cutter. And it's funny, like, even at work, like, that flipping noise, it takes people by surprise.
This is the water. This is the water, and this is the well. Drink full and descend. The horse is the white of the eye and dark within. This is the water and this is the well. Drink full and descend. The horse is the white of the eye and dark within. And this is Brendan Malekin. And this is Chris Humphrey, my hero. And this is Michael Benedetti on the 508 show.
Chris, you going to Philly or Pittsburgh?
Philly.
Do you know what the knife laws are like down there?
I have looked into them. I think they're similar to Boston in a lot of ways. I think it's a little less strict. I think Boston is certainly more strict. I don't even... when I go to Boston, I throw my knife out before I even...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like going to the airport. You just empty your pockets well in advance.
It's not worth it.
Yeah.
I want to disrupt this interesting and honest conversation and talk about the city council agenda for this week.
Fantastic.
We have a good picture of Gary Rosen here behind me. Thanks, Brendan, for drawing my attention to this. There's really nothing going on in the city council agenda. I mean, there's stuff going on, but it's like nothing really out of the ordinary going on tonight. We have a request from Patricia Soucy to make Havana Road a public street. Do you know where Havana Road is?
I do not.
It's not in Havana. It's in Worcester. It's off of... I don't know. It's down past Webster Square, down towards Auburn, almost in Auburn, I think. We have Ted Khanna and many other people who signed a petition request the city council to go on record in support of a 3-month delay of any and all irreversible destructive demolition activity at the former site of Notre Dame de Canadian Church, and request the city manager to convey this request to Hanover on the city's behalf. This feels like a real 11th hour move by their part, but they're doing it. What else do we have? We have recommend adoption of an order to amend the tax increment exemption plan for Branded Realty Group LLC for the housing development certified project at 100 Wall Street, basically turning this tax break from a 2019 to 2034 tax break to a 2020 to 2035 tax break because of some construction delays. And finally, transmitting information relative to an update of a previous report concerning what the impact would be if 4 to 8 unit properties and 9 or above unit properties were moved to a commercial tax rate using the current valuations and the rationales, blah, 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 blah. So basically the idea being that like we would decide that if you had a 4-unit apartment building that would be commercial and not residential. Mm. What would happen if we did that? You know what happened, Brendan? It would increase the commercial tax base 25% to 34%, depending on how that was done.
Did you happen to get an answer, or did you watch last week to get an answer from the pressing question of the last, I think, 3 weeks now? If we,
what's going on with this? What's going on with those people making their
sidewalks? I've been dying.
Oh, how much we'll save? We should call into the Rosen show. Why don't we call into his show?
We should just start showing up during the show and take it over. I've been. Hank, did you hear? Did Gary get an answer on that one? I mean,
this hasn't come back to the council yet. No, this is just only recently.
They're asking Gary to do his own math
no,
on how much we would save if we didn't spend $8 million.
There's a turnaround time. I really hope they have the snottiest possible report. That's just like $8 million, dumbass. Love the city manager. I mean, I'm sure it's more complicated than that, but I would rather there be a snotty.
I mean, that is the number. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, anyway. How many minutes left do we have in our show?
We need to shut.
5 minutes left. We don't know what's going on today. Everybody's like, everything is just Korean crazy today.
Shot clock, egg timer. We've invented solutions to this problem.
Brendan, have you ever seen a comprehensive housing market analysis from the Department of Housing and Urban Development?
I don't know that I have, Mike.
I just discovered this. That they did one for Springfield this year. They haven't done one for Worcester, at least one that I can find. They kind of do a bunch of them every year.
Hedging their bets that it's going to be burnt down sooner or later.
Well, they mostly do them for larger markets. So like Boston gets these all the time. Sure. But these are based on public information. So I'm kind of excited by this. It's about a 12-13 page report. Mm-hmm. I kind of want to look up the public information on this and do one of these reports on Worcester and see what it would look like. Because I think there's like Research Bureau reports, but I don't trust the Research Bureau on this kind of stuff.
You can't trust him. No.
I'll trust the public HUD numbers a little bit more.
Well, so does it say in there why they did this? I'd be curious. Is it because of the amount of development going on around the casino out in Springfield that they felt it was viable to do a Franklin County survey?
Actually, this is really weird, but it's Hampshire and Hamden County, not Franklin County.
I thought it was okay. There you go. So it's not which?
Yeah, I would never know. I don't know what county Springfield's in.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah.
But is that why? There's no
explanation. They just do it.
The letter, the words are bigger behind you. That's why I'm staring at that. It's, you know, eyes. It's.
Yeah.
So were you able to find if you've ever done one of these for Worcester?
Not one that was online. I mean, okay. I'm sure that there was probably, maybe there was never one done. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, I just think about these studies. You know, there was a study recently that showed that Worcester had a relatively high poverty rate, but a relatively fastly increasing poverty rate.
Which I question.
Or concentrated poverty rate. And this is the Worcester metro area defined as extending down into Connecticut.
That's the key.
And this is the kind of stuff where I'm like, I feel like I need to go back to some earlier numbers that this was derived from.
Yeah.
Because this is such a weird contingent statistic.
So many people picked up that story, and it was very, I think it fed flames on like the cynical crowd and whatnot, and everyone skipped over, even where it first popped up locally, and I think Go Local Worcester or whatnot, it was Worcester poverty rate. Right? They didn't put in the qualifier that this is the Worcester metro area, which is all of Worcester County and whatever that.
Well, then it's Holden.
It's Holden's bringing
and a
down.
Story.
No, but seriously, I mean, when you look at the economics of Fitchburg, Leominster, combine them even with some of our adjacent communities, like at least one of the Brookfields. The numbers are all over the place. And to say that was a sharp increase in Worcester poverty, it was disingenuous.
Yeah, I mean, whatever. I mean, I sort of feel like whatever. Like I said, I feel like I got to look at the numbers. We're basically done with the show. Oh, let me say something else about this show.
Can I do a parting thing?
Oh, like, what parting? Oh, do you want to do a parting thing? Yeah, why don't you do it while I find my paper?
Okay. If people want to say goodbye to me, like, an opportunity would be on Saturday the 19th, REC is doing a plant sale behind City Hall from 10 to 2. There'll be plants, there'll be a petting zoo, there'll be all sorts of things for the family.
There's going to be a giant 20-foot tall face of Chris Humphrey made out of flowers.
There's going to be a barracuda ape.
Maybe a tarantula.
Possibly a wallaby. Maybe a,
possibly a wallaby. No promises, but do come out.
You know, I'll be there. You know something, Chris Humphrey? You're listening to Unity Radio, broadcasting with 100,000 milliwatts of power on 102.9 FM and streaming at worcestermag.com. This show is also cablecast on WCCA-TV 194, podcasted at pinecoffee.org, and live streamed to our Facebook page. You can call in live at 508-471-5265. And thanks to the mighty Hank Stoltz for engineering today's show. Bye-bye, everybody. See you later.